They pushed through the front doors and Jackman led the way upstairs to the CID office. Marie already had three steaming beakers of coffee ready on her desk. "We'll use my office." Jackman picked up a beaker and turned to go. "Can I bring Robbie in on this, sir?" asked Marie. "Only he made the connection first." "Of course, just tell him to bring another chair." Cameron Walker looked around the book-lined office in envy. "This is nice." He took in the leather-topped desk, the captain's chair and the bookshelves. "Very nice indeed. How come I only get a glass-windowed cupboard with chipboard furniture?"
"Because you didn't trail around auctions, car boots and house clearance sales, then smuggle it all in here in the dead of night," said Marie. "Our boss is really a squirrel."
Jackman grinned. "So what have you got for us, Cameron?"
"Bottom line, a case almost identical to yours, only our lovely, contented partner and mother jumped off the roof of a London department store."
Jackman exhaled loudly. "A local woman?"
"From Beach Holby, a few miles from Beach Lacey, where I live. And from what Maria told me over the phone, the scenario is pretty well a carbon copy."
Jackman sipped his coffee and stared into it in silence. He wondered why two local women would kill themselves in London.
"The good news is that we're a bit further ahead with the investigation than you. Our death happened 2 weeks ago, and the woman did leave us some clues to work on."
"What was her name?" Jackman asked.
"Forrester. Suri Forrester."
"What a coincidence. My brother told me earlier that Sarah's maiden name was Woodman. A forester is a woodsman, isn't he?"
"Even odder," Robbie interjected. "Suri comes from the Hebrew for princess and is the Yiddish version of Sarah. A friend of mine copied the name from a couple of celebrities who called their baby Suri."
Jackman suppressed a shiver.
"The story gets darker," said Cameron in a low voice. "That's not her real name. And I suspect Sarah Woodman wasn't your sister-in-law's real name either. Both changed their names because of something that happened to them years ago. Something that neither of them ever talked about."
"Witness protection program?" whispered Marie.
Cameron Walker nodded.
"We thought that too, but it's not easy to prove. Everything is so hidden, it's like groping around in the dark."
Jackman recalled his brother saying how scared Sarah had been when he told her Jackman was a copper. She must have wondered what would happen if he started to dig into her past. It was the answer to so many questions.
"My team are tracking her history, and I'm reliably told they could have some answers by later today," Cameron said.
"Are you happy to work in tandem with us on this, Cameron? Share whatever we get?"
"Absolutely."
"I'm happy for you to lead," Jackman offered. "Let's be a double act, shall we?" suggested Cameron. "There's a good 15 miles between here and Beach Lacey. It's not just 2 minutes round the corner. You run this end, I'll keep on with our investigation, and we'll keep in constant contact."
"Yes, that's good.
What if we each arrange a liaison officer to collate everything that comes in and share it straight across?"
Cameron nodded. "Fine. I've got a lad who is happier on a computer than anywhere. He can do that standing on his head."
"And how about Rosie McKeldry for this end, sir?" Marie added. "It would be right up her street."
"Perfect." Jackman smiled. A very satisfactory arrangement, and it still left Robbie, Max, and Charlie on the ground.
"Sir," Marie looked at him, "I haven't told DCI Walker about our other death yet. The murder or suicide on the river path."
"Ah, yes. We have no idea how, but this might just be connected. Marie, would you do the honors?"
Marie recounted the story of their John Doe, adding, "But as yet, no one has come forward to identify him or even report a man of his description as missing."
"Could be a connection, I suppose," mused Cameron. "It's a bit too much of a coincidence otherwise, isn't it? Two killers with the same rather weird modus operandi. It's unlikely."
"I agree," said Jackman. "We'll keep working on that one and let you know whatever we find out."
Cameron stood up.
"I'd better get back. Thanks for the coffee, though I have to say it's no better than ours." He pulled a face.
"Since we exist on the stuff, you'd think they'd provide something drinkable."
Jackman smiled and held out his hand.
"We really appreciate your help, DCI Walker." Ditto. And it's just Cam. Less of a mouthful. Bye, Marie and Robbie. Nice to meet you both.
The door closed behind him, and Robbie said, What a nice guy. Not like some DCIs I could mention.
He's really laid back, but he's a damn good policeman. No one on his team ever asks for a transfer, that's for sure, said Jackman.
But like you, sir, Marie grinned at him. After Robbie had left, Marie said, Do you think Sarah was a witness to something, sir?
It ticks the boxes, doesn't it? You tell no one, not family, not friends. You start again, a new name, new life. It's the biggest secret you ever have to keep, for it could cost you or those closest to you their lives.
It's not talked about much, is it? Not even in our own circles.
I can understand that, although there are a lot of false theories about it, like the huge sums of money that are paid out to the witnesses on the program, which is not true at all.
A friend of mine looked into joining the Witness Protection Unit, but it meant giving up all work on criminal investigations. She would have been working solely on protecting and hiding vulnerable witnesses. She started the training, but decided it wasn't for her. She reckoned they expected the witnesses to go through a really heart-wrenching process, ruining their lives all for the sake of justice and putting some scumbag behind bars. Marie paused. So do we think that's what this is all about? Someone discovered her new identity, and that of another local woman, and threatened them?
Jackman frowned. We have to go back to the beginning now. Find out who the girls were and what crime they witnessed. Then we might be able to get a handle on who was terrorizing them.
And keep trying to identify our dead pseudo-vagrant.
Him too. That's a pretty full workload, Marie. But now Ella is staying at my brother's house and the boys are back at school. I will be on duty again as from tomorrow, okay?
Music to my ears, sir.
Dale and Liam pulled on their jackets. Kenny watched them hurry out.
What are they up to now?
Yvette's voice came from behind him, startling him. He gave her a rueful smile.
God alone knows. Best not to ask.
Yvette sank down on the stairs and rubbed at her aching shoulders.
I've just been handing out leaflets again, over to the north of Salton High Street this time. But I know they'll just end up in the gutter or the litter bins.
Mum appreciates what you're doing. Just hang on to that thought. You're doing it for her.
You're a sweet man, Kenny.
Rubbish. But I do understand how you feel, Evie. We've been fighting for so long, and no one gives a damn about an old case, do they? It's history now, and we're just another sad family who can't let go, can't face the truth that one of their own was a murderer.
You don't believe that, do you?
Kenny yawned.
That Brendan killed that girl? Of course not.
If there was a sweet man in our family, it was Brendan, not me.
Naughty, it's true, and a bit of a lad. But kill a teenager? No way, not in a million years.
But I do believe that the rest of the world just wants us to fade away.
Yvette stood up.
Want some tea?
Susie's just making Mum a cup. Let's join them, shall we? But not a word of this in front of Mum, okay?
As if. Susie and I have agreed we'll make all the right noises. Don't worry about that.
It's not me you have to worry about, Evie. It's Dale and Liam.
Oh, I know that, Kenny. I know that all too well.
Kenny painted a smile onto his tired face and followed her into the kitchen. It was strange, but as the two women succumbed to exhaustion and dejection, the more fervently Dale and Liam pursued the crusade. If he had to hear the word retribution one more time, Kenny thought he would scream. Around 4 in the afternoon, Marie took a call from Rory Wilkinson.
I'm ringing to talk to you about men's underwear.
Marie heard a stifled giggle and smiled.
Wonderful, my favourite topic of conversation.
Good. Well, your vagrant that clearly is nothing of the kind was, in my opinion, quite a well-off man. And here's where the underwear comes in. He had on charity shop clothes, but obviously drew the line at crappy undergarments. His boxers alone would have cost him over £30. And his T-shirt was Dolce & Gabbana, and no copy, I assure you. It retails at over £200.
For a bloody T-shirt? Marie exclaimed. You're kidding me.
My dear Sergeant, there are young men roaming the streets of our capital city who frankly look like dorsers in ripped jeans that cost nearly £1,000 a pair. You want designer fashion wear, you pay for it.
I think I'll stick to the high street, thanks, Rory.
Good decision. Now, back to your mystery man. Max was right about the classy haircut. Generally, he was in very good shape, well-nourished, with expensive dental work.
He took a breath.
And that could be how we identify him. He had some specialist implants. And guess what? We now have implant recognition software, radiographic recognition of dental implants, and assessment of batch numbers. Whoopee!
You are a genius.
Don't state the obvious, please. Of course I'm a genius. But when I said we, I was talking about forensics in general. I don't actually have the software here, but I know a woman who does. I shall grovel and creep, much as you do when you need something from me, and hopefully I'll have some answers by tomorrow.
I can live with that, Rory. And meanwhile, our image of the man will be going out on the local news tonight. I can't believe that no one is missing him.
And why dress as a tramp and get yourself killed? I'm not joking when I say look for this man in the higher income bracket. He was no hand-to-mouth labourer or benefits cheat. He had money, no question. Intriguing, isn't it?
Baffling.
Well, I must bid you farewell, dear lady. I need to go and polish up my sycophantic skills in order to obtain information on those implants for you. Ta-ta for now.
Shaking her head, Marie replaced the receiver. Conversations with Rory were rarely dull. She wondered if she should relay what she knew to Jackman, who had left to visit his nephews, but she decided it could wait until she had something more definite.
Sarge, while you were on the phone, Aurak tried to get hold of you. She wondered if you could go down to our underworld kingdom before you leave.
Charlie grinned at her.
I'd be happy to come with you.
What is it with you guys? You are all obsessed with that woman.
Charlie laughed.
Maybe.
Well, sorry, but I can cope alone, thanks.
Marie looked at the clock. She'd better go now. Time was getting on. Down in the basement, she really did feel as if she had wandered into a dark and creepy parallel universe. The area was quiet. That, and the dim lighting in the corridors, made her want to walk on tiptoe and speak in a whisper. Aurak beckoned from her lair.
First, I should tell you that I haven't yet tracked down whoever sent Sarah's emails, though I'm edging closer. Have you made any inroads into her secret life?
Marie took a seat in front of a bank of flickering screens.
Some. We suspect that her name is an alias.
Oh, it is. Aurak flashed those disconcerting eyes at her.
Until she was 16, the lady's name was Heather Miller.
Marie's mouth dropped open.
How on earth?
I might not have tracked her stalker yet, but I have made considerable progress with the woman herself. I carried out some checks on the name Sarah Jackman, and discovered from her marriage lines that she was apparently born Sarah Woodman. I then found an anomaly in the electoral roll and a couple of other databases, and a question came up regarding her national insurance number. I went through a few of the more official channels and came up with a change of name.
Wow, impressive.
It's what they pay me for.
Aurak gave her a half-smile.
Although they don't pay me nearly enough.
She turned to face Marie.
I'm not sure how D.I. Jackman will take this, but his sister-in-law is not the person he believed her to be.
Marie nodded.
He knows that already. He just wants answers, no matter what.
He thought she might possibly be in the witness protection program.
Aurak drew in a deep breath.
I don't think that's actually the case.
Marie frowned.
What else could it be?
She disappeared voluntarily, off her own bat, as it were.
At 16?
Yep, 16, almost 17.
I don't get it.
Marie felt totally confused.
I need to do some more work. I'm going to stay on tonight until I get to the bottom of it. But it is my belief that she and another girl witnessed something dreadful,
or at the very least saw someone leaving the scene of a crime.
Another girl. Of course. Another girl died in similar circumstances a couple of weeks ago. Her name was Suri Forrester, and she lived in Beech Holby.
Ah, that makes my life easier. And it confirms my suspicions. I just need concrete proof. I think by the morning I will be able to tell you precisely what occurred over 20 years ago to change the girl's life.
As Marie hurried back to the CID room, she ran Jackman on her mobile and swiftly told him about Sarah's change of name. He sounded as intrigued as she was, and she knew neither of them would sleep that night. She felt like a kid on Christmas Eve, unable to wait for the morning to come, except what she'd unwrap would probably not be very nice.
Chapter 11. Jackman decided that unless there was some reason to withhold information, he would keep his family, James in particular, but also Ella Jarvis, up to date with how the investigation was proceeding. Naturally, he wouldn't pass on anything sensitive, but he felt they deserved to know why Sarah had acted as she did, if only to dispel any guilt they might be feeling concerning her death. And so, as night fell, he found himself back at Raynham Lodge. When she was a Soko, Ella had signed the Official Secrets Act, so he felt he could talk to her openly. After the children had gone to bed, they sat together with two large glasses of wine and discussed the possibility of someone having driven Sarah to kill herself. Ella thought about it and nodded slowly.
She was always cagey about her past. I thought it must have been a case of sexual abuse which would explain the never-mentioned parents.
She sipped her wine and settled herself into the sofa cushions.
I had it in my head that her father had been the cause of the trouble, which is why I never tried to pry. Now I wondered if she almost encouraged my suspicions, so as to cover up the real reason for her secretiveness. It's quite hurtful to have been lied to for years, but I guess that confirms just how serious she considered the threat to her safety to be. She dared not open up to anyone.
Undoubtedly. Jackman told her they believed her real name was Heather Miller. I swear it wasn't in her nature to hurt or lie, and her love for the children and James was undeniable.
Oh, I agree, she adored them, idolized them. She would have done anything for them.
Done anything for them? Jackman mused. I wonder. Ella sat up, wide-eyed.
You think she killed herself to protect her family?
It's a possibility, isn't it?
So, the threat of violence or vengeance was directed at them, not her? She frowned. But wouldn't that mean they might still be in danger? If you're dealing with a mental case, what if he isn't satisfied with just Sarah's death?
Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
In his mind, Jackman was already arranging safe houses and round-the-clock protection for his beloved family. He hastily dragged himself back to reality.
I'm pretty sure that it was a personal attack on Sarah. I don't see that it would do much good to intimidate her family when she's no longer around.
Sins of the fathers? Volunteered Ella grimly. It has happened.
I know, but...
You see, there was another death locally, very similar to hers.
He nodded. Beech Lacey are investigating an almost identical case. We will be liaising closely with them.
Was her name Pauline Grover by any chance?
No, it was Suri Forrester.
Oh, so not Sarah's old friend, the one she mentioned accidentally.
Jackman's mind clicked into gear. Could that have been Suri's real name? The one that Cameron Walker was looking for. He glanced at his watch, pulled his phone from his pocket and found Cam's number. After he ended the call, he stared at Ella.
You're right. The DCI at Beech Lacey has just heard from his sergeant. They have traced Suri Forrester back to a change of name by Deedpoll from Pauline Grover.
Ella blinked and then exhaled.
Two teenagers so terrified they abandon everything and become different people? Phew, that is scary.
As if willing the hours away,
Jackman looked at his watch. First thing I'll do tomorrow is take a thorough look at the young lives of Heather and Pauline.
Ella sat down her wine glass and leaned towards him.
Jackman, do you think we're in danger here?
He hoped he looked reassuring. If I think that for one moment there is the slightest danger to you or any of my family, you will be protected, I promise you that.
She smiled wryly.
Okay, just being a trifle paranoid. It'll pass. I just couldn't bear to think of those children having to deal with any more upset while they are still trying to come to terms with their terrible loss.
To Jackman, such a thing was unthinkable. Tomorrow morning I'll get my whole team working on this. I was going to anyway, but there is considerably more urgency now. We need to know what happened so long ago, then we can really get to grips with who might be behind this nightmare.
Ella drained the rest of her wine.
I trust you, Jackman. And don't worry, I'll keep the children close, and I'll ask the school to be extra vigilant.
Without scaring the shit out of them.
Naturally. I'll just explain that until there's a verdict from the coroner about their mother's death, it would be prudent to be observant. I'll talk up our concerns for their general well-being.
She gave a short laugh.
I shan't be telling them we suspect an axe murderer lurking in the climbing frames.
Jackman laughed, but it faded quickly. They sat in silence. He looked at Ella's worried face and wondered if her thoughts were as dark as his. While Jackman was preparing for bed, Marie was still sitting at her kitchen table, looking at a hot whiskey toddy and the copies of the emails sent to Sarah by the man, or woman, who hated her so much. She had already skimmed through them, but now she went over them slowly, trying to find some clue hidden in the words. She sipped the warm drink, her mother's recipe, and wished it could dissipate the chill that the messages brought. Insidious, threatening, and full of menace, they were shocking to read. They mentioned nothing concrete, but all alluded to something the sender knew had happened, for which he blamed Sarah. There were numerous references that sounded biblical. His mischief will descend upon his own head. If what you do is evil, be afraid. Another, time's glory is to unmask falsehood and bring truth to light, seemed more like a literary quote, possibly Shakespeare. She turned the pages, wondering how Sarah must have felt. Did she believe that she was to blame for this thing that had happened? Marie sighed. In the end, the author of this dreadful barrage had got his way. Sarah had paid for what he accused her of. She read the last message aloud.
O daughter of Babylon, you devastated one, how blessed will be the one who repays you with the recompense with which you have repaid us. How blessed will be the one who seizes and dashes your little ones against the rock.
The paper shook in her hand.
Dash your little ones against the rock.
She took a long swallow of the fiery whiskey. Now she knew why Sarah had so readily thrown herself into the deep waters of the River Thames. The evil bastard had threatened her children. Marie thought of the other woman. Had it been the same with her? Cam Walker did say she was a mother, didn't he? Marie swore. She drained the rest of the drink, pulled the papers together and stood up. She needed to try and sleep. Jackman was back tomorrow, and they had a hell of a lot to talk about. The church wasn't the only place he felt calm. He also liked woods, being sheltered inside a natural cathedral of tall trees, with only the sounds of nature around him. But they were hard to find on the fens. Tonight the church was locked. So he chose a point far out on the marsh, a place that few people knew about. It was a miserable spot, bleak and almost impossible to find. With one rough lane in, it was inhospitable and the track to the raised sea bank was overgrown with nettles and brambles. Just below the bank, there was a Second World War pillbox, its pitted walls covered with lichen, and its roof with self-seeded couch grass and weeds. If he climbed on top, he could see across to the flat expanse of marsh, and sometimes, if the tide was in, the silvery grey waters of the Wash. Other than the occasional poacher, no one would attempt to come here in the dark. It was why he loved the place. To sit on top of the pillbox and see a vast expanse of nothing extending out before him. Out here, it was possible to believe in nothing. To forget all loyalties and purpose, other than the impulse to destroy. But he had purpose, he reminded himself. He had loyalty, and he believed. He believed in himself. The power he felt when those two women jumped was indescribable. Immense. Such power he had over them. He took a deep breath of the air, heavy with salt, held it, and let it out slowly. He had watched them do it. He had seen the looks on their faces. He had seen them relinquish the strongest impulse of all living beings, self-preservation. When you know where love lies, true, selfless love, you can also destroy. That was the source of his power. Love, as a lethal weapon. He began to laugh, louder and louder. There was no one to hear. It was late when Ella finally got to bed. The boys had been restless. Miles had cried for almost half an hour. She sat with them, listened to their questions, and tried very hard to say the right things, things that would help. She had used the word dead rather than asleep. She knew it was important that they appreciated that their mother was never coming back. She thought Ryan understood, but Miles lived in a fantasy world, where the wizard would always wave a wand and restore the hero to life at the very last moment. He had to be made to realize that that didn't happen in real life. Ryan had asked, "Was Mummy cross with me?" "No, sweetheart," she said. "Your Mummy loved you very much. Why did you think she was angry with you?" "Because she was acting funny all week." He stared hard at his duvet and refused to look her in the eye. "How do you mean, funny?" Finally, he looked up at her, pain and bewilderment in his eyes. "One minute she was mad at me. Then she would hug me so hard I couldn't breathe. It was really weird." "Adults do act weird sometimes, Ryan. We have a lot to worry about, and sometimes we take our worries out on the wrong people." "That was most likely it. She told you off. Then she was sorry she had, so she hugged you." He pursed his lips. "I suppose." Then he brightened. "Yeah, that would have been it, wouldn't it? I mean, she did say she loved us more than anything in the world." Almost immediately, he lay down and snuggled into his pillow. She got ready for bed, thinking how different the two boys were. Ryan was serious and practical. He enjoyed games. He played. But he was calculating and measured in everything he did. In short, he was his father's son. Miles, on the other hand, was easygoing and fun-loving. Gregarious, artistic, and full of imagination. Just like Sarah. She had believed that Miles would give the greatest concern, but now she wasn't so sure. To her knowledge, Ryan hadn't shed a single tear. He hadn't had a tantrum, nor did he seem especially sad. Apart from that single question earlier, he just seemed to swallow the whole thing and store it away in his mind. Did that mean he couldn't deal with it? She lay in bed and listened, in case Miles was still crying. The house was silent. It was good to know that Jackman was just a few doors away. He had tried to ease her worries, but she was good at reading people, and knew Jackman was as concerned as she was. She must remember to tell him what Ryan had said. It added to the supposition that Sarah had done what she did to protect her children. It was a terrifying thought. Ella turned on her side and lay awake, her eyes open in the dark. Chapter 12. That morning's meeting went on for almost 3/4 of an hour until Jackman finally wrapped it up and delegated the tasks for the day.
So, Rosie, you are our contact with Beach Lacey. I want you to work closely with their liaison officer, DC Darren Smith. Make sure nothing gets overlooked. Every new piece of information that comes our way is passed directly to them and vice versa, okay?
DC Rosie McKeldry nodded enthusiastically. She had a quick brain, and this job would be a refreshing change for her.
Great, sir. I'll ring Darren and we'll set up a system.
Good. Now, he looked around. Charlie, I want you and Gary to concentrate on identifying our John Doe. We're certain there is a connection to Sarah, but until we have an ID, we are dancing in the dark.
He handed him Rory's pathology report.
Professor Wilkinson now thinks he has a way to identify him through dental implants, so chase him up on that. Find out who this man is, and fast.
Jackman turned to Robbie and Max.
You two are going to concentrate on the time when the two women took the names Sarah Woodman and Suri Forrester. It won't be easy, but Max, you should tie up with Orac on this.
Max's eyes widened and he grinned.
Got you, boss. I'm on it.
I bet you are.
Rosie flashed him a warning glance. She had been Max's girlfriend for the past year.
Marie, you and I will continue this conversation in my office. There are some loose ends to tie up, and then we'll start to dissect my sister-in-law's early life and find out all we can about her friend, Suri Forrester. Okay, guys, to work. And I expect something for the 4 o'clock meeting.
Marie closed the office door behind her. She had already told Jackman about her suspicion that someone had been with Sarah when she died. Jackman had looked at the CCTV footage again, and his face had spoken volumes. It wasn't absolutely certain, but there was a good chance Sarah was looking at someone standing behind her. Jackman was reading through his emails. He gave a sigh of relief.
The inquest has been opened and adjourned.
Marie smiled.
As we hoped, but it's good to hear it from the horse's mouth.
I think we have Rory to thank for that. The coroner established identity and the fact that the cause of death was drowning, but, following the pathologist's report, he adjourned to await the forensic and full toxicology reports. He also commented that the police have advised further investigation, so the verdict will wait, pending the results of their inquiries.
Great. We have a bit of leeway.
Marie looked at him.
Okay, sir, what's the problem?
He sighed.
Ruth Crook. The super's not certain that I'll be able to maintain a professional attitude. She's worried about a possible conflict of interest, because Sarah was my sister-in-law. I've assured her that we were never close and pointed out that the reason for that was my commitment to my career, but she's considering asking me to stand down and let someone else take over.
Marie groaned.
Oh, hell. How do you feel about that little bombshell?
Soddingwell pissed off.
Marie almost smiled. Jackman very rarely swore.
Can I help at all?
I can speak to Ruth if you like. She and I get on pretty well after that case involving her niece. I've even learned to let the heavy sarcasm go over my head.
I have to keep hold of this case. I have to.
Jackman sat back and folded his arms. Marie didn't say it, but she could see Ruth's point. It was too close to home. What if the man behind it all decided to target other members of Jackman's family? There was no way he could remain in charge if that happened.
How long has she given you?
Today. That's all. Just today.
Jackman looked desperate.
I've got to see her first thing tomorrow with a full report on where we are. She'll decide then.
So, we need to buckle down and get some answers. You know Ruth, sir. She'll not do it lightly. If we can show her something within 24 hours, I'm sure she'll let you run with it. So come on, give me some work to do instead of fretting over something that might never happen.
Jackman straightened up.
You're right, Marie. Sorry about that.
He gave her a tired smile.
Not enough sleep last night. In fact, practically no sleep at all. Marie smiled back.
Same here. Aurak said she would stay late at work until she found the connection between Sarah and her friend Suri. I've been wondering all night what those two teenagers might have been involved in.
Right, well, I thought you should trawl through police reports of serious crimes from the time just preceding Sarah's change of name.
And look for cases that involved 15 to 16-year-old girls?
Yes, and not just as possible witnesses. It hurts me to say this, but check anything that has them as victims or even perpetrators. If someone wants retribution, it could be because of something they did, rather than what they saw or suffered. I can't believe that of Sarah, but we have to consider the possibility.
Absolutely, sir. And an open mind will be exactly what Ruth will be watching out for.
I had thought about that myself, said Jackman smugly. I'm conducting a fair investigation, but also covering my back.
Good. And so you should.
Sir, was Sarah a local?
Hard to say. Although she did have the accent. Not too pronounced, but I'd say it was natural and not acquired.
Narrows my search somewhat. So what will you be doing?
Trying to trace anything I can about Sarah when she was Heather Miller. Birth certificate, christening, school records, health and hospital notes, anything to give us an idea of who she was before she became Sarah. Cam Walker is doing exactly the same with regard to Pauline Grover. The moment either of us sources something, our carrier pigeons, Rosie and Darren, will pass it over.
Neat. So, let's get to work. I hate to say it, but the clock is ticking.
Just after 11, Charlie almost fell into Jackman's office.
We've got him, sir. Our John Doe's got a name.
Good lad.
Jackman hadn't expected a result so soon.
You'd better thank Prof. Wilkinson, sir. He found us the dentist who fitted the implants, and all we did was contact them and get his details. The dead man's name is Bernard Seaton, and he lived out Harlem Marsh way. Gary and Kevin Stoner are on their way there right now.
Excellent. Tell them to come directly to me when they return.
Will do, sir.
Charlie hurried back to his desk to begin checking Bernard Seaton's background. Jackman returned to his work with a little more enthusiasm. At least the swift identification of the dead man would earn him a few brownie points with the superintendent. If they could add another step forward, she might rethink her plan to remove him. He stared at the screen. Just how many million Heather Millers were there in the world? He cancelled the search and went on to check school records. If he knew where she came from, it would help, but right now it was pretty random. He hoped that Marie and Robbie were having more luck than he was.
I hate coming back to this area.
Gary Pritchard's voice was uncharacteristically somber.
But you lived here for years, didn't you, Gary? Asked Kevin.
I did. But apart from my sister and my lovely dogs, it wasn't a happy place.
Oh, yes, I forgot. Harlem Marsh was where they found all those
Let's not go there, Kev. It's too painful.
Sorry, mate. That was a very bad case, wasn't it? I wasn't thinking.
Kevin changed the subject.
Do you know the address we're looking for?
Gary gazed across the miles of flat fields, mostly full of kale, sprouts and various kinds of cabbage.
I know the entrance to the lane, but in all honesty, I've only ever been down there once. It goes nowhere.
It's one of those strange roads that curves around the fen for miles, and then ends in an overgrown turning place with nothing but farmland as far as the eye can see. Kevin stared at the silent sat-nav.
So, we are looking for a house called Marlin's. And it looks like we're on our own with finding it.
Gary took a left turn into Herne Bank Lane. As far as I recall from when I worked this patch, there are only three or four houses down here. Kevin stared down the lonely road.
Blimey, this is pretty bleak, isn't it?
I wouldn't like to live here. You want to see it when the rain is being driven by a 60-mile-an-hour wind. The day I came here it was blowing a gale. And it gave a whole new meaning to the word miserable, believe me.
They drove for almost a mile and a half passing only one dwelling, a farmer's ramshackle cottage called Utopia, which made Kevin laugh for several minutes. The next one looked slightly better. The nameplate, The Willows, hung appropriately from a huge willow tree.
Two down, muttered Kevin, and another one in sight around the next bend.
Gary slowed down and negotiated a sharp bend with deep dikes either side.
This has to be it.
The address I visited was the last house before the dead end, and I don't think it was called Marlin's. They turned into a semicircular gravel driveway, and Gary pulled up outside the front door.
Oh, my, exclaimed Kevin. It's a diamond stuck in a turd.
The house was big and well cared for, with a triple garage and a carport with a dovecot on the roof.
Our tramp's house? Asked Gary.
It's called Marlin's, and our dentist informed Charlie Button that the man's implants were some of the most expensive you can buy, so, yes, I'd say this is the Seaton residence.
They rang the doorbell and heard it ring inside the house, but no one answered.
Long way to come just to turn around and go home again, said Kevin thoughtfully.
There might be someone out the back. You go right and I'll go left. Gary started off towards a gate at the side.
You won't find anyone in.
Gary jumped.
Where did you come from?
He stared at the elderly man who had materialized behind him. He was wearing a waxed jacket and had a Jack Russell on the end of a faded and frayed leash.
We looks out for strangers around here. I saw the police car as it went past my place.
So you know Mr. Seaton?
Bernie, sort of. Not well. He's a bit of a recluse. That's why he bought this pile stuck out here in no man's land.
He lives alone in this big house?
Asked Gary in surprise.
Yes, quite alone. No cats, no dogs, no budgie, nothing.
The man looked fondly down at his own dog.
He must get lonely, although a few weeks back he had a visitor come regular-like. Must have been a relative, I suppose, but he never said.
Did he say where he was going, sir?
Just away, no more than that. Asked me to keep a watch on the place. Keep my eyes open.
The man was around 70, guessed Gary. Fairly well dressed, but his clothes were far from new.
Can I have your name, sir?
Derek Keats, officer. I live next door in the Willows.
Gary decided that the man was no threat and that he wanted him on side.
Well, listen, Derek. I probably shouldn't be telling you this, but as Mr. Seaton obviously trusted you...
Gary paused, then added,
and remember, this didn't come from me, and it still has to be confirmed, but a gentleman who we believe to be Bernard Seaton has been found dead.
Oh, dear.
Oh, dear.
The old man rubbed at his wrinkled cheek.
That's very bad news.
Kevin joined them and produced a copy of the digitally enhanced photograph.
Is this Mr. Seaton, sir?
The man screwed up his eyes and squinted at the picture.
It's not the best likeness, but yes, that's Bernie all right.
He looked at Gary.
What happened to him?
I'm afraid we can't say, as it's an ongoing investigation, sir, but we are going to have to take a look around his home. Gary looked at Kevin.
Ring this in, Kevin. Now we know this is his house, we need a forensic sweep done.
I have a key.
Derek Keats fished deep inside a breast pocket of the old jacket and produced a shiny Yale key.
In case of emergencies, he said, and I guess this constitutes an emergency.
Gary smiled.
It will also save any damage, sir. Thank you.
As soon as he stepped inside, Gary knew that something was wrong. On first glance, it would have looked quite normal, until you noticed small indications of damage. A photo torn into shreds. A piece of what must have been valuable china crushed almost to powder. A leather-bound book burnt in the fireplace. Someone had selected particular items and systematically destroyed them. Gary and Kevin pulled on latex gloves and looked around. The hall opened onto a big open-plan lounge dining room that led into a massive conservatory. It was light and airy, and stank of money. Nothing was cheap. The carpets were rich and thick, the curtains beautifully hung on ornate poles, and the furniture must have cost a fortune.
"A tramp?" Kevin whispered.
"No way was our Bernie destitute." Gary's eyes narrowed. "I don't like the look of that, do you?"
A single hard-back chair had been placed in the center of the dining area. Two lengths of rope were still attached to it. One piece hung from the back, and the other from one leg. They moved closer, careful not to disturb anything.
"Someone was tied up here, and I'm assuming it was Bernard," mused Gary, "while someone else walked around his home, smashing and annihilating his precious possessions. What do you think?"
Kevin nodded.
"That's what it looks like. But why?"
"I suggest our visitor wanted something badly."
Gary looked at the torn photograph.
"It's a child. A little girl. And it's pretty old, certainly not taken on a modern-day camera. I'd say it was a treasured memory."
"And Mighty Boy shredded it," Kevin grimaced.
"Ouch, that would have hurt."
"So would this."
Gary bent down and peered into the fireplace. Beside the old burnt book, there was a bundle of letters, still with a singed strand of ribbon around them.
"Love letters, unless I'm just being a romantic old fool."
Kevin looked over his shoulder.
"Love letters for sure."
Gary heaved in a deep breath.
"This man, whoever he was, hated Seaton so much that he tortured him. Not physically, but by destroying the things he held dear."
"I wonder who this Bernard Seaton really is," Kevin said. "Should we take a look around? See if he has an office. He's sure to have some paperwork that might give us a clue."
Gary shook his head.
"I'd love to, Kev, but this is a crime scene. We'd better wait for the Socos to get here or we'll be accused of trashing the evidence, if there is any. Hopefully the others back at the office have already traced his history now they have his name."
On their way back to the hall, Gary noticed some letters placed on the hall table. He looked through them and passed the pile to Kevin.
"Forget my last comment. Look at these."
"Ah, I see what you mean.
They're not addressed to Bernard Seaton at all, but to Philip B. Seaton. And this one," Kevin pointed, "says to P.B. Seaton, Q.C.
Hell, he was a Queen's Counsel."
"So he was a barrister, was he? That shines a very different light on why someone might have hated him, doesn't it?"
Gary reached for his radio.
"The team need to hear this, unless they've made the connection already."
"And here come the CSIs."
Kevin was looking down the lane.
"I'll just go and check that our friendly neighbour and his dog are out of the way, and tell him not to broadcast the news just yet. We don't want the press on the doorstep before we've had time to process the scene."
"Good thinking, lad."
Gary called in their discovery and waited for the scene of crime officers, wondering what other secrets this beautiful, lonely house would offer up. Chapter 13. Information was beginning to stream into the CID room, and Jackman retreated to his office to collate what they knew in time for the 4 o'clock meeting. He was in full flow when a soft tap on his door interrupted his efforts. He swore under his breath and barked,
"Come in."
But when he saw who it was, his face softened and he broke into a smile.
"Laura, come in and sit down."
Laura Archer, the force psychologist, returned his smile.
"I know you're busy, well, run off your feet, but that's actually why I'm here."
He tilted his head and looked at her.
"I don't..."
"Your nephews and your brother are not the only ones who need support, Jackman. I'm here for you too. So, how are you coping?"
Jackman exhaled. Where to begin?
I would say fine, and that I'm on top of things, except for the fact that I'm under extreme pressure to get results fast or I'm off the case. That is where the stress comes from.
Conflict of interest?
He nodded glumly. Even though I saw less of Sarah than I do of our dog handler, and I see him perhaps once a fortnight. I just want the truth to be found, most of all for my family's sake.
And if that truth is uncomfortable?
It will still be the truth, Laura. That's what really matters.
He sat back and stretched out his legs in front of him.
I can find a way to explain the truth to Ryan and Miles, but I can't explain guesswork and lies, and I won't lie to them.
Laura gave him a long look. You seem to be approaching this in a practical and healthy way. I'd say your added incentive will actually assist the investigation rather than hinder it. If it will help, I'm on my way to speak to your superintendent about another matter, and I will tell her that you have my full support to continue as OIC on this case.
If you can swing this, Laura Archer, I will take you to the Watermill restaurant and treat you to the best meal of your life.
The Watermill? That will set you back 6 months' pay. I'll settle for that little French restaurant in Bridge Street, thanks. The Sol Meunier with a bottle of Sancerre is like rising to heaven. She paused. And we needn't wait. We could go there any time, if you like.
Jackman blinked. He contemplated her soft light brown hair and cornflower blue eyes, and decided that there was nothing he'd like more. Well, that's a date. After the case.
And if the case goes on forever?
Then we renegotiate. He grinned at her. Now I have another incentive to get a fast result.
Laura stood up. I have to go. But remember, if you feel at all shaky, you have my number. Don't hesitate to call me any time, okay?
Jackman thanked her. He opened his mouth to remind her about the dinner date when there was a loud rap on his door.
Marie stuck her head in. Sir, you'll want to hear this. Oh, apologies, I didn't realize. Hi, Laura, sorry to interrupt, but, sir, we've worked out the connection between the two girls and our pseudo-vagrant.
Jackman felt a rush of excitement. He glanced at his watch. It's almost four. Is everyone here?
Apart from Gary, who is still at Seaton's house.
Then get them together, and I'll be right there.
While Jackman addressed the team, Marie could see Laura Archer and Ruth Crook in earnest conversation in the corridor outside the CID room. A few moments later, they both slipped quietly inside and leaned against the wall at the back.
So, Marie, would you please bring everyone up to date on the latest findings?
Marie walked up to the front and stood next to the whiteboard. Earlier today, we confirmed that the man found dead on the towpath was called Bernard Seaton of Harlan Marsh. Since then, a search of his home has revealed that he's actually a retired QC by the name of Philip Seaton. Gary Pritchard and Kevin Stoner have since told us that Seaton was apparently held hostage in his own home and made to watch as his precious personal items were destroyed. A neighbour noticed that a strange man was visiting Seaton regularly. Seaton was known to be a recluse, so we believe that the visitor was the man who assaulted him. She took a breath. The neighbour's description of this visitor corresponds to eyewitness reports of the man who was seen with Seaton while he was living rough here in Salton, so we suspect that this is the man who assisted Seaton's supposed suicide. She looked across to Robbie Melton. Robbie?
Yes, Sarge. He stood up. I've checked back on a series of high-profile cases that Seaton dealt with when Sarah Jackman was a teenager, and I've come up with one definite possibility.
Everyone looked at him expectantly.
Seaton was the prosecuting counsel at the trial of a man called Brendan Simmons. Simmons was convicted of the rape and murder of one Lindsay Ashcroft and given a life sentence.
Marie took up the story. And we believe that this is the connection, because there were two key eyewitnesses to the attack. Two teenage girls.
She waited for the murmurs of surprise to die down.
And the timescale fits? Asked Jackman.
Perfectly, sir. The girls were never named. Due to their age and the fact they had witnessed the rape of one of their school friends, they were allowed to give their evidence in camera. They were only ever referred to as Girl A and Girl B.
When was this? Asked Jackman.
Mid-90s. But that wasn't the end of it. I remember that the media had something new to say about this case almost every week, and then Brendan Simmons, who protested his innocence to the last, hanged himself in his prison cell.
Jackman whistled softly. And the family took up a crusade that is still rumbling around in the press. I saw something about it only the other day. But listen, everyone, don't make assumptions at this point. It would be very easy to assume that the family are behind it all. And maybe they are, but you mustn't get sidetracked. This is a complex case, and there will be a lot going on that we know nothing about. This is a massive step forward, but possibly just the start of the investigation proper, okay? There were nods.
So the girls were put into the witness protection program for their safety? Asked Charlie.
Marie pulled a face.
Too soon to know. It seems probable, but as you know, they don't just hand out information. You have to go through the correct channels and obtain the proper authorization, and I haven't had time to pursue it yet. My initial inquiry yielded nothing, but naturally I will be following it up. Plus, there's always the chance that they, or their families, might just have taken it upon themselves to up sticks and find a new life. We need to do a lot more investigating in that area.
Thanks, Marie. Jackman walked back to the front. Seaton's house is being carefully searched and forensics are carrying out a sweep. We're hoping to find some reason for Seaton's sudden strange transition from a prominent barrister to a recluse, hidden away in the bleakest part of the Fens.
And then to street dweller, added Max.
That was never of his choosing, I'm sure. He was made to do that. We just need to know why and who made him do it.
Are we assuming that the same man caused all three deaths, sir?
Rosie asked. We assume nothing yet. But I think that's the conclusion we'll come to. It's all about retribution. We have a maverick wandering around Salton Le Fen, a vigilante with a twisted desire for revenge. He looked at each of them in turn. What we don't know is how far he is prepared to go to assuage his hunger for revenge. He's dealt with the witnesses and the prosecutor. Is the judge next? Or the jury? Or the officer in charge of the investigation? Jackman swallowed. This is very serious, and we need to put all our efforts into identifying this killer as speedily as possible. He looked up. I need to speak with the superintendent, but if you would all remain here for the time being, I will be back shortly to issue your duties. Marie will fill you in on the rest of the details. Thank you all in advance for what I know to be your wholehearted dedication to getting this man off our streets. Marie, take over, please. Marie wondered if they'd done enough to keep Jackman on the case. Surely they couldn't have done any more. She guessed that Laura might have put in a good word too. Why else would she have been talking to Ruth just prior to their meeting? She smiled. When she had walked into Jackman's office earlier, had she been mistaken, or was there a ripple of electricity in the air? For some time now, Marie had been on the lookout for a suitable partner for Jackman, and Laura was the perfect candidate for the Evans eligibility test. Why hadn't she thought of her before? She was intelligent, professional, and caring. Plus, she was pretty and dressed well. Laura made Marie feel like a hod carrier by comparison. Also, Marie really liked her. Well, if they needed a little push. Ruth Crook began the moment the door closed behind them.
I suppose I'd better put you out of your misery, Rowan. You have a stay of execution, okay? I'd be a fool to lose the momentum that you've built up.
She narrowed her eyes.
But if at any time you feel that your position as officer in charge is at all compromised, you stand down immediately. Is that understood?
A weight lifted from his shoulders. Jackman nodded furiously. I'll treat this case professionally, ma'am, I promise.
Ruth paced her office.
The very thought of the Brendan Simmons case rearing its head once again fills me with horror. They are a tricky family to deal with, and if the rumours in the media are correct, the mother is far from well. You will need to tread with the utmost care, Rowan.
You sound as if you've had dealings with them before, ma'am.
She looked glum.
Several times, and I'd rather not repeat the experience.
I haven't had time to go over the case, ma'am. Is there anything particular about it that I should know?
Ruth sat down and nodded to a chair.
I think I'd rather you read the reports yourself and drew your own conclusions. The case divided the officers who were working it. Young Brendan was a bit of a tearaway, but he had never been in trouble before. Some believed his claim that he was innocent, and others thought him guilty as sin, and that he was using his cheeky good looks to literally get away with murder.
And when he killed himself, how was that perceived? Was it admission of guilt, or the fact that he couldn't face a life sentence knowing he was an innocent man?
Again, divided. Most thought he was guilty and couldn't live with himself after what he'd done.
I'll read the transcript after the meeting and see for myself.
Jackman stood up.
I'd better get the guy sorted out. Thank you, Ruth. I won't let you down.
Jackman finished delegating the tasks and saw Marie beckoning to him.
While you were with the super, I heard from witness protection.
That was pretty damn quick, exclaimed Jackman.
Only because they were adamant that no one connected to the Lindsay Ashcroft murder trial was put on the program.
Blast, Jackman growled. Does that mean we've got the whole thing wrong?
No, sir. Just that the two anonymous girls were not considered to be under threat. Brendan Simmons was safe behind bars serving a life sentence, and their identities had been kept under wraps. It wasn't considered necessary.
Right. Then I think it's time we acquainted ourselves with exactly what happened to Lindsay Ashcroft, don't you? Asked Jackman.
And then get the super to access the names of those two young witnesses. Until we know for sure that they really are Sarah and Suri, we could be chasing our tails.
Her eyes sparkled.
Not that I believe that's the case for one minute. We are on the right track, sir. I know we are.
Chapter 14. Marie was right. They collated all the information from ORAC, DCI Cameron Walker at Beach Lacey, Ruth Crook, and whatever they had found themselves, and by 7 that evening they had the strange story of Sarah and Suri. Engrossed in the work, not one of the team asked to go home, but they did accept the offer of pizza courtesy of Jackman. He summed up what they knew as they ate.
The start of it all is the murder of Lindsay Ashcroft back in 1995. Ruth Crook has been told that the names of the two teenagers who gave testimony at the trial were Pauline Grover and Heather Miller, or Suri and Sarah, as we know them. The murder took place in a small town called Nettleby, in the north of the county. The teenager who was killed went to the same school as the girls, and Brendan Simmons, the young man who was convicted of her rape and murder, lived in a neighbouring village. He was known to all three girls. He sipped at his coffee. Philip Seaton was the prosecutor, and apparently he did a very good job of not only securing a conviction, but making sure that Simmons got life. He glanced across to Gary Pritchard.
You found some very interesting evidence at Seaton's house, didn't you?